Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. Ward Hurlburt and Deborah Erickson. Why don't you join us as we discuss the mission and activities of the Alaska Health Commission. To reach us with your questions and comments, call us locally in Anchorage at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. Deb, nice to have you here for the first time. And Ward, nice to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Ward Hurlburt is the Chief Medical Officer of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. He serves as chair of the Alaska Health Commission, and he's also director of the State Division of Public Health. And Deborah has been executive director of the Healthcare Commission, and she served for more than 20 years as in the Division of Public Health, including positions as deputy director and chief of the section of community health. So each has a long history in public health, particularly here in Alaska. It's just a real pleasure to get to talk with both of you and discuss the commission. Deb, why don't we start by just helping us understand what the commission is, how it came into being, what's the constituents in these, and what's the purpose?
Sure. I thought it would be helpful maybe just to talk about some history about health care reform in the state for a few minutes before we got started with that. And there have actually been a number of groups formed over the past 20, 25 years by governors under executive order or, in particular, a task force formed by the legislature in the early 90s when President Clinton was working on healthcare reform at the federal level, all concerned with the rising cost of healthcare, with access to healthcare in the state and the quality of care in the state. All of these groups, though, by their nature, were short-termed. Their lifespans were anywhere from 6 to 18 months, but they basically produced a report and went away. And there was no consistency over time, no focus on studying the complexities of our healthcare problem over time, and no real accountability for following the recommendations and if and how they were implemented. This current commission now was initially established by Governor Palin at the beginning of 2009 under an executive order, but then the legislature established it in state law this past year in 2010. And so now for the first time we have a more or less permanent body in place who can study the issues of healthcare quality and cost and access over time. So our current group just started meeting again. The Governor Parnell appointed the members this past September, and the group started meeting in October most recently. And their focus is on fostering the development of a comprehensive health plan for the state, focused both on healthcare cost, quality, and access again, but they're also charged with developing a strategy for improving the health of Alaskans as well. And the group meets approximately quarterly, every 2 to 3 months, and is responsible for producing a report to the governor and the legislature in January of each year.
Mm-hmm. So it's become a more important long-term goal. It sounds like the legislature has taken this up as a very important part. Is there a particular reason why they saw that it was necessary to do this?
Part of my belief of why they were finally felt compelled after at least 25 years of considering periodically whether to establish some body permanently is if you look at where healthcare costs and healthcare spending were in Alaska in just the early 90s, the last time a legislative task force convened, healthcare spending in the state, total spending, all payers for all services, was just a little over $1.5 billion. And today we're looking at well over $7 billion in spending. And Dr. Hurlburt will talk a little bit more about the cost of healthcare and pricing for healthcare in Alaska in a few minutes. But I think the extent to which healthcare is becoming less affordable and also starting to consume an increasing proportion of government resources was what was really driving the concern. And at the same time, not necessarily seeing overall improvements in health or improvements in access to healthcare services as a result of the increased spending.
Which echoes the national situation. Mm-hmm. Lots of money being spent, not a lot of evidence that we're getting our money's worth, is the way you put it.
That's
simply.
Right.
Is that true?
That's right. So, I mean, just one of the things that's a primary focus of the commission is looking at how we can improve value that Alaskans get for their health care dollar.
How many members?
There are 14 members. 11 of those are voting members. The three non-voting members, we have a representative each from the House and the Senate. Senator Donnie Olson and Representative Wes Keller are legislative members. And then the third non-voting member is a representative from the governor's office that's representing the governor's office, but Linda Hall, who's the state insurance commissioner. She's the director of the State Division of Insurance. And then the 11 voting members, the statute actually names the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services chief medical officer as the chair of the body. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Hurlburt, of course, is the chair. Then the other 10 members are representing mostly the healthcare sector. We have a couple of non-healthcare representatives, a consumer representative, and also a representative of the business community. And that's Keith Campbell's in the consumer seat, and right now we just had a vacancy, but the former CEO, president of Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, Wayne Stevens, had been on the group for the last couple of years. But then we have representatives of licensed healthcare providers and also specifically a primary care physician. Dr. Larry Stinson and Dr. Noah Laufer of Anchorage are in those two seats. Pat Branco is currently the CEO for Ketchikan General Hospital. He is also president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. He's representing the Hospital and Nursing Home Association on the group. We have a representative for Community Health Centers. David Morgan's in that seat. A representative for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority representing behavioral health providers and constituents. And Emily Ennis of Fairbanks is in that seat. Just a couple others. Health insurers are represented. Jeff Davis, who's the mm-hmm. president of Premera mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, is representing health insurers in the state. And then there is a seat for someone involved with medical services for the Veterans Administration. And Colonel Paul Friedrichs, who's the commander of the hospital in Elmendorf, sits in that seat.
These are, you mentioned that the governor appoints all of these, or how are the individuals selected?
The governor appoints all of the members in the voting member seats,
okay.
and then also the one non-voting member who represents his or her office. And then the president of the Senate appoints the senator to represent the Senate, and the speaker of the House represents the representative from the House.
And they have staggered terms, and so each a new governor may have to appoint people at various times down the road.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. They all serve 3-year terms, and since we're new, we're just appointed to staggered terms. Mm-hmm. So we'll have approximately 3 people rotating off each year.
Remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line One. We're talking about the Alaska Health Commission. We've just introduced the idea of what it's all about and who the constituents are. We're going to discuss next what their major areas of activity are, and then we plan on discussing as much as we can about each of these different activities. But if you have questions or comments, please feel free to give us a call or drop us an email. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email is line1, and you have to spell it out, LINEONE, at KSKA.org. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So in preparation for this, Deb, I ask you to kind of tell us, what are the major areas of focus? Where are you guys looking at right now? Would you kind of describe those to us, and then we'll kind of take those at a time and see where it takes us.
Sure. Well, one of the things the commission is, in terms of their process, trying to spend more time learning about the current condition of Alaska's healthcare system, and then at the same time working on studying different policy options, different strategies that they could potentially develop recommendations around for making improvements in the system. And so areas that we're focusing on studying, trying to understand better the system right now, include cost and pricing for healthcare services in the state, and also health status of Alaskans, with the health of our population. Some of the areas that they're considering developing recommendations around, and so doing some more study around different policy options, include evidence-based medicine, different approaches at population-based prevention, patient-centered medical home care model, health information technology, and also healthcare workforce development. And there are a couple of issues, too, that they're at this point just tracking, and those are access to primary care for Medicare patients and the status of federal health reform and implications for Alaska and how it's being implemented in Alaska.
Okay. Well, it seems like a large amount of work to do, if you ask me. It seems like it'll be enough to keep people busy. It'd be just hard enough to figure out where we're going with federal health care on a day-to-day basis and how to make decisions. Before we address each one of these, I think we're going to try to start off by discussing what's going on and what we know and maybe need to consider about cost and pricing. I do have a phone call that's already come in, and I'll go ahead and take that phone call. Alan, you're on line one.
Hi, how you all doing?
We're good. What can we do for you?
Well, I heard you guys naming off representatives from various medical organizations and stuff in the state, and I didn't hear one mentioned for Providence. I'm an employee of Providence, and just wondering who represents our interests in this commission.
Well, first, one of the things I probably should note is that the state law that established the commission actually designates the seats and the representation for each of the seats. There is one seat on the commission among the voting members for the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And so I would say Providence interests generally as a hospital in Alaska are represented by the member filling that seat.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much. Dr. Holbert, what do we need to know about cost and pricing in Alaska, and how are you guys addressing that on the commission?
Well, as Deb said, the commission has several charges related to cost and access, quality of care, prevention. But I have said a number of times, and I deeply believe it, that if it were not for cost, we would not have a healthcare commission. In the United States, we're faced with spending about 18% of our total gross domestic product on healthcare. And in Alaska, we know our costs are the highest of anywhere in our country. If you look at the 27 industrialized countries around the world, the next country is at 12%, and the other 27 run between about 7% and 12% in terms of dollars, where we spend about $2.75 trillion a year on health care now. That's around $9,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. The next closest country would be Switzerland at about two-thirds of that, about $6,000. That's an economic challenge to our country. And then you ask, what do we get for what we spend? We don't live as long as folks live in almost all of those other countries. Our babies don't survive quite as well. And so we know we have wonderful medical care, we have high technology care, but we do spend a great deal of money. And that's become a big driver for it. What does that mean in Alaska? In fiscal 2012, starting in July, we expect to spend $1.5 billion just for Medicaid. That's more than Deb quoted the number that we were spending in the early 90s for all Alaskans for health care. That $1.5 billion next year is an increase of $200 million over what we are spending in the current fiscal year. That's about $13,000 for every enrollee in Medicaid. There's about 110,000 to 120,000 enrollees on the average in any given month. They're mostly children, mostly young women, who other than childbirth do not incur high costs. Some are the aged, blind, and disabled, and they're very costly. But it's an economic reality for our state. It's an economic reality for our employers. It's an economic reality for our citizens. And so cost is a major factor for us. Medicaid rates in Alaska, for example, that is the fees that are paid, are about 2.5 times what they are for the same service in Washington state. Data from the private sector reveals that private insurance companies pay about twice what they do in Washington state. So cost is a big driver for us. We don't want to compromise on quality. We know there are certain unique things that do drive cost in Alaska, and we want to understand that better. But cost is a big factor in creating the commission and in our work.
The several individuals that I've interviewed over the years on this program have made a point that there is a distinct difference. Since we're talking about health care costs and we want good quality health and health care, they have pointed out that there's not the relationship that many of us might guess between health care provided by providers and the overall quality of health. And we, as you've mentioned, we're spending a lot of money, yet, and although our health is better, I don't think anybody can argue that, we're still, as I understand it, falling behind most of Western society. So it may be that there's factors outside of health care that also need to be addressed, is the point I'm making.
That's absolutely correct. In my own personal experience, I came to Alaska almost 50 years ago now and went to Dillingham, served at the Kanakanak Hospital there. We averaged about 25 patients in the hospital in beds at any given time, about four times what it is today for a larger population. Most of those patients were young, sick infants, young children, and it was due to diseases that came that were preventable. Because we didn't have good water, we didn't have good sanitation, we didn't have measles vaccine, we didn't have other things. So those things, housing, water, sanitation, immunizations, have made a huge difference in reducing infant mortality rates and having a larger population. Today, back then we died mostly from infectious diseases, accidents, and injuries. Today, we die mostly from what can be called diseases of choice, mm-hmm. complications of overweight and obesity, of smoking, mm-hmm. of poor choices that we make. The Centers for Disease Control projects that 38% of all the American girl babies currently being born will be at high risk of being diabetic as adults, about 34% of boy babies. For some ethnic groups, such as Hispanics, female babies have more than a 50% risk of being diabetic. The White House paper, the publication on overweight and lack of activity in children that Michelle Obama has been so interested in and has been sponsoring, predicts that this current generation of Americans being born this century may be the first generation of Americans since the founding of our country to not live as long as their parents, because of the complications of overweight and obesity. So absolutely, there's a difference between healthcare and health.
And it implies a corollary to that is a lot of what is happening to our health is to a significant degree outside of the ability of providers, traditional health providers, to control. And I mentioned another issue, which is a huge problem and the leading cause of death in a large group of our younger population, that's accidents, injuries, suicide, murder, and so forth. How are the members of the commission receptive to this idea, and is it being discussed in what kind of ideas and changes or thoughts are being pursued?
I think that providers can play an important role in many areas in prevention. Probably next to your parents or your kids, the most effective person in getting somebody to stop using tobacco is to have the physician or the other provider to recommend that. We know it takes many tries on the average for somebody to stop. Or if the physician or other provider advises you about your weight or advises your parents about it, that's very credible, and it is an important role to play. But there are other things within our society. I think that it's extraordinary. It's unusual for a governor to so publicly foster and take the stance that Governor Parnell has related to domestic violence and sexual abuse. I think that's admirable, and it's admirable that he tells his own family story about his grandfather there. But he recognizes that the incidence of domestic violence and sexual abuse in our state is a cause of concern and dismay for all of us. It's not something that's going to be cured by the physician, by the nurse practitioner, or by others, but we have to take it on societally. But young people who do experience domestic violence and sexual abuse then are at very high risk for sexually transmitted diseases, for teenage pregnancies, for problems in dealing with life. They become quicker. It's associated with higher instances of obesity and so on. And so it is something that we as a society need to say, it's enough. We can't have it anymore. And I think it's really admirable that our governor's taking the lead on that.
Okay. Reminder, listeners, once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Deborah Erickson, who is executive director of the Alaska Health Commission, and the chair, Dr. Ward Holbert. We're discussing the activities of the commission and their plans and information that they're dealing with day to day. If you have questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. Staying at least one more question on this cost and pricing issue, which is clearly a problem for the nationally for us, and especially up here in Alaska. As you pointed out, we're one of the most expensive places to get health care in a very expensive country. And I was at a meeting recently where physicians were talking with a health insurer as part of a kind of advice group, and the question came up is why, and this was asked by a physician and supported by other physicians, why can't we as a country or a state have more transparent fee structure? Why can't a patient who has a problem, needs an appendectomy, needs a mammogram, check more easily, quickly, and effectively as to how the price would vary in different places within our own state?
I think that can be done. Healthcare has been different in that so much of it is paid for by what we would call third-party payers. Some individuals have had what would be called first-dollar coverage, so that you don't need to pay anything out of pocket. Health insurance has really only been around since about the mid-30s to any large extent when the Blues plans really started. Health insurance can be seen as covering somebody for the catastrophic emergencies that if you're not Bill Gates, almost nobody could afford to cover. But health insurance, really starting in the Second World War, partly because wages were frozen and it was a way to provide more compensation to employees, covered more and more. So if you have very little out of pocket for health care, that puts you in a different situation than when you're buying an automobile. There has not been that economic driver there, but I think we can. I think we're seeing in many parts of the country. And one of the challenges, one of the tasks that the Healthcare Commission has adopted is to strive to have greater transparency in what pricing is, in what costs are. Because as the consumer understands that and knows that, they can be more active and there may well be more competition. But it has been kind of unique in that sector of economy that's not been visible to the users.
Now, when I go on the internet and go to Wikipedia, my first stop all the time just to get started, and you look up insurance, you find that the word is insurance is about to protect people from costs that they cannot otherwise endure. It's catastrophic stuff. That's why you insure your house. You don't want your house to burn down. You don't want to insure a key man because you don't want to be able, your business may depend on that key man. And what we did in health insurance, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, is we said, we're gonna give you everything. In fact, when we started, it's going to be pretty damn cheap. It's not going to cost you anything. So there was no incentive. for the consumer, the physician, anybody to ask what the costs were. And aren't we now backing away from that in all health care plans, everybody's situation, to make the consumer or the person who has the insurance a little bit more responsible for first dollar?
I think that that's true. There is the health savings account concept was intended to be that way, to give the consumer more control. It's become a little bit of a political football. It's more of a Republican thing than a Democratic thing in our country, and that's unfortunate now. But the intent behind that was to have the person have more, quote, skin in the game. So that they would be more astute, more sophisticated purchasers.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and any emails and talk with Dr. Ward Hulbert and Deborah Erickson about the Alaska Health Commission on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Okay, welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today my guests are Dr. Ward Hulbert, Chairman of the Alaska Health Commission, and its Executive Director, Deborah Erickson. You can email your questions and comments to 550-8433. Our email address is line1@kska.org, and our long-distance toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded segment that's being rebroadcast, and we won't be here to answer your questions at that time. Deb, we've talked about cost and pricing. I guess we could continue the rest of the hour on that, but let's move on to another issue the commission is looking at, and that's the health information technology. I don't think the public is quite as aware as I am of what's going on day-to-day to improve the interconnectivity of all of us in healthcare, and also that connectivity is going to increase with the consumers. And maybe they don't know that yet, but that's my guess. What do you want to let us know about this issue?
The commission has been focused from the beginning on this particular issue because the healthcare industry is so far behind other industries such as finance in maintaining their information in electronic format. And so our initial focus on health information technology was specific to development of electronic health records, moving from paper files to electronic medical records, and also development of a health information exchange, which is a mechanism for different healthcare providers and healthcare provider organizations to share that electronic information on patients that they might be serving in common. And a third aspect of that the commission was focused on was telemedicine, which is using telecommunications to transmit and provide health information and health care services over a distance. So those were the three main aspects of health information technology that the commission's been focused on initially again. And the significance of electronic health records as a powerful tool for improving patient safety, but also improving efficiency of the delivery of health care and the coordination of care is really significant. But There's also a significant amount of challenge involved in that. It takes an incredible investment on the part of healthcare providers and healthcare organizations to invest in the technology in the first place. And then as significant as that is, the amount of time that they have to spend training and convert for their staff, converting systems. So it's as easy as it might sound, it's not at all an easy task in making that conversion. But more and more, there are some systems in place to support the conversion. Our state legislature passed a law a couple of years ago now, creating a health information exchange for Alaska. Again, that platform that will allow transmission of information between different electronic health records. And that system now, the State Department of Health and Social Services is responsible for it. They've contracted with a group called the Alaska eHealth Network, who's actually developing the system for the state. And they're moving along quickly and actually expect to begin pilot testing this system sometime in just the next few months, just a little bit later this year. And at the same time, then, of course, the system that needs to be in place for sharing the information relies on individual providers and doctors' clinics, hospitals having their information maintained electronically. And so just an example of a program that's just recently been implemented to support physicians and hospitals in developing electronic health record systems are through CMS. Both Medicaid and Medicare have electronic health record incentive program in place. Now, Alaska's one of the first states in the nation to implement the Medicaid electronic health record incentive program. They actually just made their first payments to providers a couple of weeks ago under this program, just to provide a little extra money to help support the establishing these systems in their offices.
Yeah. I've heard it described, maybe this will help the listeners understand what we've been struggling with, is that it's kind of like having a tile floor where we got all these tiles all over the place. We got no grout. And so that connects and holds everybody together. I think that's a pretty good analogy. And so what's happening is the government, the federal, the feds and other people, and I think appropriately so, they're helping us lay down the grout so we can talk to each other much more effectively.
I have not heard that analogy before. That's a good one.
Rick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I hope you'll forgive me for backtracking a little bit in terms of my topic. I want to talk a little bit about the economics, but first of all, thanks for being there, everybody. you know, we'd be much like the third world if we didn't have, you know, some of the high-tech equipment and, just basic in the trenches kind of things that are used for healthcare, whether it be dressings or IV equipment or whatever. I mean, obviously, those are things that that are of value and help us. But, you know, the question was raised by you, Doc, about transparency and costs. And, you know, I have been frustrated with healthcare costs since a personal experience with when my first child was going to be born. And we, you know, went into what we thought was sort of an alternative center for birthing. It was within the hospital, but supposedly friendlier to the citizen, to the consumer. And when I got an itemized bill, you know, I saw things like for example, a little piece of foam of a foam strip to hold the transducer that, you know, for monitoring fetal tones on the belly. A piece of foam rubber that was an inch wide by, you know, 36 inches or something, they charged $35 for a piece of foam. And if you go to, like, if you're getting to the hospital, if you go to the ER and you need some emergency care, and they're going to give you a 400 milligram or an 800 milligram, a higher dose ibuprofen, and they charge you like $10 for a tablet. Those kind of things are what really, I think, those are just two small examples of what really kills the consumer in terms of the cost of healthcare. And, you know, going back to how I originally started my tirade here, you know, we have R&D, research and development to create techniques and new products, and those are all important, but on the backs of the consumer's wallet is how we pay for that through through drug costs that don't cost that much to produce, but by the time the user gets it, it's killing them. And I don't know how, I think transparency is incredibly important, but I think it's going to always be a huge a challenge, because the people who are charging $10 for an ibuprofen or $35 for a piece of foam rubber that is not high tech at all, they don't want to see that. They don't want to see people knowing what they're charging and what kind of prices they're getting for that stuff. So I'll get away. I'll stop. And thank you very much for being patient with me. And I'll listen off the air. Okay.
Right,
thanks very much.
Unless
you need me to be on for a comment.
I think we got your point.
Thanks
for calling, Rick. Ward, Deb, any comments?
Well, I think the examples given are known to all of us. We right. hear those examples.
Right.
I once won a prize for making the closest guess to what a diaper costs for a premature on the average in the hospital, $37.50 for a diaper. And so those charges are there. Partly in a reaction to that, there has been actually for quite some time now a movement on the part of payers, whether it's government payers or health insurance companies, to pay differently, and the payment may be either on a set number of dollars per day or a case rate basis where you pay so much. And that would tend to remove the incentives for that kind of unit pricing that none of us can understand when you pay so much for a Tylenol pill or a diaper or something like that.
Yeah, Rick, I agree. I think the important thing is to know is that's why the commission is – one of the reasons the commission is in place is because there are numerous examples, including from our own physicians themselves, about the problems. The issue, I guess, that gets me is understanding why these things cost like they do, and we're constantly making efforts to make these things change. There have been a number of attempts over the years. Until we really understand why, I don't know if we can do the right thing, but we appreciate your call. Let's take another caller. Don, you're on line one.
Hi, Dr. Woodard. Thank you for taking my call. I want to tell you that I am a donor, so thank you so much for sticking with the pledge drive there. We're hearing a lot about the expensive cost of obesity and those diseases, heart disease and diabetes. I think that Alaskans, nearly 65 to 68% of Alaskans are currently overweight. We also know that nearly 90% of our vehicle trips are trips within 3 to 5 miles of places, of our destination places, for example, work, school, or the grocery store. And that's a pretty short distance. With that knowledge, and additionally with the knowledge that we know that going to the gym is not enough, we hear a lot of information coming out that, the hour or so at the gym is not enough these days to reduce obesity. My question is, what are we doing right now? What is the state doing right now to try to promote active transportation? For example, are we working, is the state working with state DOT or municipality agencies when we're building roads in order to make these roads a little safer for bicycles and pedestrians so that people are encouraged to get out and get exercise throughout their day and provide safe environments for them? I've heard about health impact assessments, and so I just wonder if the state is working towards some kind of policy to encourage people to get a little bit more exercise in their daily life just by walking and bicycling back and forth to work or school.
All right, Don, we're going to answer your question, and I'm going to broaden it a little bit because I want to make sure we touch on several of the broader issues that the commission is addressing, and one of those is prevention. So, Dr. Holbert, I don't know if you want to address her specific question, but also what's being done in the whole range of prevention, which I think is what she's really getting at there.
Yes, Don, I appreciate your question. I say bless your heart for calling in and what you're saying. The direct medical costs in the United States for the medical complications of overweight and obesity have now substantially passed those for the complications of the use of tobacco. Tobacco still kills more people, but obesity's coming up on that. So regarding your specific question, yes, we do have folks from the Division of Public Health that participate in some municipal planning type ventures where there is development, where there are new roadways, to make sure that there are paths that are there, that there are ways that people can safely be active. Where we have a significant challenge where our young people are overweight and are obese, we do see a few good things happening. Not enough, but a few good things. The Matanuska-Susitna School District and the Municipal Council and the Borough up there have taken this very seriously. They've gotten sugar-sweetened beverages out of the schools. They've improved their menus. They've improved the use of physical education and physical activities during PE times and recess times, pushed after-school activities. And so just about 3 or 4 months ago, we have for the first time seen a downward slope in the curve of the amount of overweight and obesity among the young people in the Matsu schools. That's the first time we've seen it in this state. And 2 points doesn't make a permanent change in things, but that's what it takes to start a trend. And so there is a sensitivity to that. We have an organization or a group called ATCO, Alaskans Taking on Childhood Obesity. The commissioners of both the Department of Education and Early Development and Health and Social Services sit on that group. Carol Como sits on that group from the Anchorage School District, who has been very interested in that. The Department of Administration, which provides a health insurance for state employees and retirees and others. The first priority has been looking at young people and what can we do to try to have the next generation of Alaskans not have the dreadful problems of overweight and obesity and all the medical complications that we've had. But prevention is an opportunity. We can change these things that we have. Thank you for your question.
Let's have a couple of callers that are hanging on. I'm going to ask them to hang on because I want to, again, make sure we address at least more than half of these major issues of focus. And let's talk about evidence-based medicine. What is meant by that? Why is that important for the commission to be addressing? Why is it important for the state? Why is it important for the country?
In one of the very first meetings that the commission had after Governor Palin appointed the commission heard an estimate that about a third of all medical care that's provided is not supported by the evidence. Now, why is that important? It's important because it can do harm. There's very little that we as physicians do to or for patients that doesn't have some risk entailed. But it's also important if we're spending $2.75 trillion in the United States on health care every year, that if 30% of that is not supported by good, solid, concrete scientific evidence, that's $900 billion a year, or like a TARP every year that we're spending without getting a good return on that. Now, each of us who are physicians feels that we have spent many, many years being trained. We continue to get our continuing education. We read our journals. We listen to lectures, and we try to keep up. But the field of knowledge has expanded so much. Scientifically, if you have a study where it can be done, and it can't be done all the time, but we have what's called a randomized double-blinded study. That means if you take individuals who come in who are comparable in terms of age, health, and so on, and assign them randomly, just by chance, to either receiving the intervention or not, that's a randomized allocation. And then you can also design that study, say if you're giving a pill, and that's probably where it's easiest to do it, to either give the medication or a placebo or comparing two different drugs, so that neither the physician or nurse or whoever is directing the treatment, neither they know which patient is receiving the drug and which is receiving the placebo, nor does the patient. And then when you evaluate the results, you have a physician or another evaluator likewise doesn't know who has received what. When you unblind that, then you can see, did that therapy really make a difference compared to another therapy or compared to placebo, compared to no therapy? Those results can then be subject to statistical analysis. There is always going to be a small chance that things can happen just by chance. Generally, if that chance is 5% or less, we say that result is statistically significant. That's the strongest grade of evidence. but much of clinical practice has not been subject to that, much cannot be. There are other kinds of studies that can be done of populations, but what is probably the weakest grade of evidence is what's called either expert opinion or consensus conferences. Again, back 50 years ago, when Alaska Native young children had pussy running ears, that was as common as a cold in those days, and that we see very little now because of better housing, better sanitation, and so on. The expert pediatric otolaryngologists from universities around the country were brought together and said, what should we do? The answer was, well, there's something wrong with the anatomy. You need to take out the tonsil and adenoids as soon as you can do that. And so there were clinics on mattresses in log cabins around Alaska with massive programs that did nothing and presented great risk. So those were the experts. That was a consensus of the experts, but it was not very solid scientific evidence. As physicians, all of us can look back on our own history with times that we have done something we were absolutely convinced was the best thing to do for our patients, and we learned later it really wasn't the wisest thing to do.
Just to put a little bit more perspective on this evidence-based medicine, from my point of view, is it even though a large amount of medicine is not evidence-based, and I don't disagree with that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the physicians and healthcare providers involved aren't attempting to give the very best care they can. As you implied, there's tremendous amount of medicine and information being generated now, and this gets back to health information technology that can help the physician at the time of service find out fairly quickly and effectively what is a cost-effective management, or does it exist for this particular problem. That's another thing I think people need to understand that's going on in a bigger frame of reference.
It's a challenge, particularly for a small group of physicians, which is what most medical practice is in Alaska, but there are sources of information that can be made available. The evidence really needs to be used in two ways. One, it should be used by payers in determining what will be covered, because we can't cover everything just because it might possibly help. But the evidence helps you make good decisions in that way. But it's also used in the individual setting between the physician or the PA or the nurse practitioner and the patient. And in those settings, the decision always has to be tempered by the reality of that face-to-face setting. And in this day and age, the decisions made collaboratively between the patient and the physician. So on the payer side, it's a little more hard and fast. What do you pay for? What does the evidence say is something that should really be done? On the clinical decision side, the decision has to be tempered by the reality of that face-to-face interchange.
Good point. And another point perhaps that we should discuss as well is these evidence-based medicine doesn't always address another important issue, and that's cost-effectiveness of health care, which is certainly a critical issue, although you certainly can apply science to the cost-effectiveness. Can you want to address that issue?
I'd love to. It's correct. Evidence-based medicine has been somewhat pure in that it is not considered cost. The cost-effectiveness research that's been talked about more the last couple of years or so brings cost in. For example, Provenge, which is the new drug that was approved by the FDA for men with prostate cancer, will on the average increase survival for men with prostate cancer by 4 months. Provenge is three doses of medication with a total cost of $93,000. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about an old Swede from Minnesota who took the drug but said, if I was paying for it myself, I sure wouldn't have done that. I would have left that $93,000 for my grandchildren. So comparative effectiveness research does look at cost. We like to think that cost shouldn't be a factor when we're talking about saving lives, but it is a reality in lives for all of us every day.
Okay. Bill, you're on line one. Thanks for hanging in there. What can we do for you?
Okay, real quick. I know you're winding up here. Thank you, sirs and ma'am. cost effectiveness and evidence both hit into what I would like to one of you to address would be, for instance, what it costs us to get clean water, reliable, to all the rural villages particularly, where and what that cost of disease is from not having clean water that's been promised for so many years. And also another preventative would be eating locally, growing locally. That addresses the obesity program, and these are pretty much just prevention issues that if the medical establishment continues to get behind it, seems like the least amount of money to spend to get the best back for it. And the other thing would be medical university in Alaska with all we spend, either through grants or what, to put people working out into the villages. Pretty much that's it, except I know how to cut health care costs just like everybody else in half, and that's deny health care into three lobbyists access to the government, but that won't happen. So,
all right. Bill, we'll try to address those issues. Thanks for calling. Bart, do you want to handle that?
Yes, your mention of water and sanitation, that's one of the most important things that we can do. And we've made tremendous progress in Alaska, but in rural Alaska, what we call the bush, there are still greater percentages of homes that do not have adequate water and sanitation compared to anywhere else in the country. And it is a major factor. It's made more difference in having more people live long and be healthy than all of the medical things that I did in all my life as a physician. It's extremely costly in Alaska, in the rural areas, to do that. I can remember back a long time ago now when the water and sanitation was first put into Barrow for the homes there, and the cost on that was about $300,000 a home. Not many places can afford that, so that's a part of our challenge. But the federal government and the state government over the years has been committed. It's never been enough. It's never gotten to where we want to be, but we still continue to make progress, and you're absolutely right in identifying that as being a critical element in helping folks have healthier lives.
So it's another one of those issues. We got X amount of dollars, and we got to prioritize where we get the biggest bang for our buck. Deb, one other issue the commission is struggling with is Medicare access. I'm 63. I'm thinking about it. What are we doing?
Well, access to Medicare, specifically primary care services for Medicare beneficiaries, has been a growing challenge, especially in urban Alaska and especially in Anchorage. I know a study that the University of Alaska, the Institute for Social and Economic Research, did a couple of years ago found that I think only 17% of all of the primary care physicians in Anchorage were accepting new Medicare patients, and I've heard anecdotally recently that it's down to as low as 5% or even maybe even fewer. As far as solutions on the horizon, there are a number of local provider organizations that are stepping up and attempting to try to fill the gap there. I don't know that there's a fix coming from the federal government at this point. Medicare, of course, is a federal government program. The concerns that we hear from physicians who are declining to accept new Medicare patients, physicians who are dropping their existing patients when they enter the age to be eligible for their Medicare benefits, is that Medicare doesn't reimburse enough to cover their costs. And the other concern that we hear the most about are the onerous administrative requirements, the burden of all of the paperwork that the federal government imposes, and the audits that they're required to go through. I don't think the commission sees any help coming from the federal government in terms of those two challenges anywhere in the near future. However, Providence recently opened a clinic that they're subsidizing, a senior care center. They have, I think, three physicians now who are providing care, and they're accepting new Medicare patients, and they're hoping to ramp up and add a couple more physicians by this summer. Just anecdotally, I thought I would mention, not to discourage folks from going there, but I just heard that their physicians have wait lists into July already at this point after just having opened it in January. So I think that's just evidence of how great a problem this is in Anchorage especially. There's another clinic that the state legislature is helping to support the startup of, Medicare-only clinic. Alaska Medicare Clinic is the name of it. Dr. George Rainier, I believe, was on your show, Thad, recently, talking about that clinic. And they have secured space for their facility, and I hear have hired a physician recently and are hoping to open their doors in May. And then a third local organization here in Anchorage, the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, is in the process of building a new facility. They're doubling their clinic space and will be adding a number of new providers once that space is doubled. And they plan to have a medical pod, a whole clinic devoted just to providing care for seniors. And with the addition of new space and new providers, we'll be able to accept more Medicare patients. And they are slated to open in August of 2012. So, to the extent that there is some hope in sight for Medicare beneficiaries, I think it's the local solutions that some of our healthcare organizations in Anchorage, there's also a new clinic in Wasilla, Hospital in Fairbanks is focused on this problem as well. I think that's how that problem's going to be addressed, at least in the shorter term.
We're into our last minute and a half, and one issue I think, or one comment I'd like to make, is that we have a link on our website, ksKA.org/line1, which will get you to the commission's website. Deb, is that a good way for people to see what's going on? Is there other or better ways to find out, or is that one of the best?
That's the best way for now. There's a link on that site where folks can join the commission's listserv. And okay, we have several hundred folks already signed up who we send updates periodically over email to let them know about when the next meetings will be. And they can always write to me at the commission with any of their concerns they want to share with the commission. All of the commission meetings are open to the public. And we make a point of holding a public hearing during each of the commissions. So any member of the public who wanted to attend the meeting, either telephonically or in person, is welcome to testify during that time. So,
any final comments? We just got a couple of seconds. We'll wrap it up. Well, listen, it's a very important thing that we're doing. It's a complex issue. I'm glad I'm not involved. It's going to take a lot of information to kind of solve this healthcare problem in this country and this state, but we all need to be working on it. I see some things happening that are beneficial, so hopefully you guys will keep doing this kind of good work. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
So my thanks again to Deborah Erickson and Dr. Ward Hulbert. We'll return next week when we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's disease with the education director of the Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska, Lisa Warzonik, and a board member, Natasha Pope. So why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, April 25th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. I'm sorry I didn't get to all the callers, but thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who did call and email. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.